Alaska Public Media's Every Little Bit recognizes people who go above and beyond to strengthen our community in Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
I think if someone wants to start a community event, they should just go for it.
I believe in serving your neighbor, love one another.
There's always something that you can do.
Wherever people meet one another's needs, all of us are enriched by that.
Do you know someone doing good in your community? Nominate them at alaskapublic.org/littlebit.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and today we're uncovering some of the wildest and oddest stories Alaska has to offer. The idea for this show was inspired by an article that was written by my first guest, James Bartlett. The article is titled When Walt Disney Came to Fairbanks, and it uncovers the not-so-well-known trip that Walt Disney took well before Alaska was a state and before Disneyland was built. The story is full of intrigue, including a secret mural that was painted by Walt himself, an unsolved murder, and an early Disney movie that was filmed in Alaska. Later on the program, we're going to have more Alaskan oddities with historian and friend of the show, David Reamer. But right now, I'm happy to welcome James Bartlett, the author of When Walt Disney Came to Fairbanks. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So despite your last name being kind of a well-known Alaska name, you are not from Alaska. You are a journalist based in LA there. How did you end up finding this story about Walt Disney coming to Fairbanks back in 1947?
Well, yes, you are actually right. Of course, people can tell from my accent, I'm from England originally. But yes, every time I've been in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, people have always said to me, are you related to the Bartlett? Which I've always wished I could say yes. Because that would give me a great connection.
Absolutely.
To Alaska. But yes, finding the story, it came about just when I was doing my research for a true crime book I'd written called The Alaskan Blonde, which looked at the murder of Cecil Wells, who was a very successful businessman in Fairbanks. The murder happened on October the 17th, 1953, and it actually kicked the opening of the Anchorage Airport off the front newspaper page. In the Anchorage newspapers, in all the countries, in all the cities across Alaska, his murder was the headline story, not the opening of the Anchorage Airport, which shows how important it was at the time, what a sensation it was.
For sure.
And as I was doing the research for the book, I was talking to some still living family members and friends of the family who were involved as I sort of re-examined in the case. And there was a family who were very close to the Wells family, to Cecil Wells and his family and extended family. And they told me that during that period in 1947, 1948, Walt Disney came to Alaska and came to Fairbanks, and Cecil and his then wife had showed them around. And Walt had been in Fairbanks and had been to the local country club and had been to their home and had drawn a mural in their basement. And so, of course, initially I thought, well, this sounds all a bit like a flight of fancy, and it's probably just an apocryphal story more than anything else. So I didn't pay too much attention to it. But then one of the other family members sent me some photographs of Cecil and of Walt and his daughter. And then I started to take it a little more seriously, but I only ever saw it as sort of a side story to the main story, to the murder and the investigation of the murder. But then eventually I thought to myself, well, I really should look into this a little bit more to see if this really did happen. And there was very little online about Walt's visit. He came with one of his daughters, Sharon, and there was only one piece online about it. But I did a little more digging recently just to get the full details and to really flesh it out. And it was reported. And it was reported in the Nome Nugget, and it was reported in the News Miner in Fairbanks. So it really did happen. So I thought it might just be a little interesting story, because I think everyone's always interested in Alaskan stories for sure, but certainly anything to do with Walt Disney, people just love that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the inspiration behind his visit to Fairbanks was that he wanted to start a new film series, right? He was going to have these movies called True Life Adventures and Alaska.
True Life Adventures.
Yeah, Alaska and the Fur Seal was going to be the very first subject of this series, right?
That's right. It was a research trip for him for a series of documentary films that he commissioned, that Disney commissioned. But it also was a business trip. As you might imagine, there was a group of them that went, a number of couples and some businessmen, and he was with a number of other notable people who were all involved in a business. There was Daryl Zanuck, who produced The Grapes of Wrath and All About Eve, and Hal Roach, who's a very famous comedy producer. He produced Laurel and Hardy Pictures. There was a businessman, and there was their family, and they were going to several locations in Alaska to look into some business interests, which were gold and oil and mining. But Walt, of course, had said he was there to do research for this series, and the series became a very successful series. It was a documentary series, true life documentary series. And the first one, as you said, was 1948. It was called Seal Island, and it won six Oscars. It won an Oscar, and the series won six Oscars overall. So he, yes, it was a work and a business and pleasure, as they say these days.
Right. And so this film, Seal Island, went on to win an Oscar. It's not a small prize, even for a Disney movie there. I want to play a small clip of it now.
High up on the rim of the world, near the top of the globe, in the shadow of the North Pole, lies Alaska. From a corner of Alaska, dipping westward in a long sweeping curve, the Aleutian Islands stand like a row of boundary stakes that mark off the Bering Sea from the Pacific. In the middle of the Bering Sea lies a cluster of tiny volcanic islands. These are the Pribilof Islands. Hidden by mist the whole year through, these remote specks of land have long been known as the Misty Isles. It's behind this curtain of fog that nature plays out one of her greatest dramas. A story strange as fantasy, yet a story straight from the realm of fact. For this is a true life adventure, the saga of the fur seal.
James, have you read about what the general response was to this movie? I mean, especially with Alaskans, what did people think of it in the theater? I mean, it won an Oscar, but what did the people think?
I think the people were pretty pleased with it. Firstly, I think people who didn't know much about Alaska, which was fair to say was most of America at the time, because as you said in the introduction there, Alaska wasn't a state then, but still very much a territory that people didn't know a lot about. And Disney was very keen to really actually send photographers and cameramen and producers into Alaska to really film actual genuine footage rather than do it, which would be much easier and much cheaper to do it somewhere else. So the documentary series went down very well because it was really considered to be a genuinely accurate documentary series. And the series itself won several more Oscars, and is still well regarded, even though it's, 80, 60, 70, 80 years later. The series itself is still well regarded as a really good documentary series that really went to the actual place and looked at the actual animals.
Right. And, Disney still makes those kind of movies now. We should probably mention they make the Disney nature movies. They just released one last year called Tiger. They had the Penguin movie with Jason Sudeikis as the lead penguin. I'm doing the voices. So, I mean, it's been a long time project for Disney to do these nature style documentaries. Well, I want to talk about Cecil Wells more, James, the businessman that Walt Disney met with and he also stayed with. You mentioned that mural that Walt painted in the home of Wells. What can you tell us about that? How did you find out about this?
Yes, well, that was at the time, Cecil and his fourth wife, Ethel, and some of their children lived in a house on Illinois Street in Fairbanks, which is still there. It's just across the Chena River. And because Cecil was a big player in Alaska, in Fairbanks, he was very pro-statehood kind of guy, which Disney was as well. He gave a speech at the country club in Fairbanks that night saying that, Alaska needed to work at being a state. And so they had met him a couple of times. They actually met Disney up in McKinley Park, which is now Denali Park or McKinley Park again, depending on which you prefer. And he and his wife met Disney and his daughter and the group up at McKinley. And they stayed there for several days, all of them. And then they came back down to Fairbanks. They had the dinner at the country club where he gave a speech. But he came back to the house afterwards, after the dinner. And this is when allegedly he drew a mural in the basement. It was like the playroom, the downstairs underneath a basement. And he just did one on the wall. Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck was apparently who he drew, to say thank you, I guess, for fun. But the reason I knew about it was that the family, the Messer family, Jim Messer was the father of that family, and he worked with Cecil at his car dealership. And so the Messer family and the Wilson family knew each other very well, still do. And so the kids had been around, and of course they knew about it. They heard about it. They heard the story. And so when I'd been in Fairbanks researching the book, every time I met the Messer family, who were very nice and took me out for lunch, and they mentioned it every time. And it was just clearly a story that had happened and they had heard about. It wasn't just something that was made up and sounded like, oh, that sounds like a good story, but did it really happen? They were
Right.
very clear that it had actually happened. And so, of course, the first thing I said, once I could hold my tongue for a second, was, well, what happened to the mural? I mean, you said one of your sisters actually saw it and you all knew about it. What happened to the mural? And of course, tragically, I got two versions. One version was that when he divorced his fourth wife, Ethel, she was so angry that she had it whitewashed over after the divorce. The other one I heard was that when Cecil married again to Diane, his fifth wife, they had a row, and out of revenge, she had it painted over. So
Right.
either way, it could. I mean, I'm sure if you went into the basement of the house and chipped off some of that paint, it might be there. But I've asked. Obviously, I asked. Is it possible? Can you go down there? Is it? And it's been whitewashed over. I mean, this was 70 years ago. But that
Yeah.
was the story, and they were very clear to me that it absolutely existed, and that it did get done, and that Disney did it, and he was there. So he was in Fairbanks, and he was at the house.
Right.
So I very much believe that it could have happened.
Oh, you better believe I'd be chipping away at that paint if it was my house. I would do anything to
Definitely.
find out if it was still there and salvageable. I'm sure that it's not, but either way, a tragic loss. That could really be quite a tourist attraction up there in Fairbanks to have a mural painted by Walt Disney himself. Well, in your book, you cover the murder of Cecil Wells. He ends up being murdered. And the demise and the accusations of his wife, Diane, who you also mentioned, and she was allegedly having an affair at the time. So, what can you tell us about that trial and how it all shaked out in the end?
Well, this was a few years after Disney had visited. It was 1953 was when Cecil was murdered, and the story went, Diane, who was his fifth wife, who was the much younger, very attractive, much younger wife that Cecil had married in 1949, she said that two men had broken into their apartment in the Northwood Building, which is in the center of downtown Fairbanks. Two men had broken in and immediately shot Cecil in his bed, beaten her, and taken money and jewelry and escaped. The police did think this was a plausible scenario because there had been a number of robberies turned violent. But then some of the information didn't quite add up. And then somebody suggested that Diane had been having an affair with Johnny Warren, who was a local musician. He was a black man as well, which at that time turned out to be more scandalous than the actual murder itself. That was when all the newspapers and the pulp magazines and even the press in the lower 48 and internationally covered the story, because that was so much more of a scandal than actually the murder. But the real link to Alaska is that Ted Stevens, who I'm sure everybody who's listening knows, that was one of his early cases. He was the US attorney in Fairbanks at the time. He was new into the job, just a few months into the job. So this was probably his biggest case that he had had at the time. And as the case unrolled, Diane and Johnny Warren were both arrested and charged with the murder, and there was due to be a trial the next year in April 1954. The trial never happened. No one never came to trial. It was never officially solved, in part because Diane Wells unfortunately committed suicide about a month before the trial. And so that kind of ended the case. And so it still remained unsolved. But as I found from the Messer family, when I had been in Fairbanks, and the still living members of the Wells family, of course, who were children then, but of course are adults now, or grandparents even, they wanted to know what had happened. It had never really been discussed amongst the family. So they all had their own theories as to what had happened, which went from sort of, it was Diane that did it, it was Johnny Warren that did it, it was somebody else that did it, it was organized crime that did it, maybe it really was two burglars who had broken in that did it. And that was really what just drew me to the book, was to just try and find out what had happened, because I thought it was such a fascinating sort of film noir type story. that there had to be some sort of book somewhere, but there really wasn't much information. So I spent sort of on and off 5 years sort of researching it. And obviously the last chapter of the book, as all good last chapters of a book do, say what I think happened on the night of murder.
So, James, did Walt Disney ever get involved in this trial at all? I imagine he didn't.
No, I was, as you imagine, I was quite desperate to find out if he knew anything about it, because I
Right.
wondered, perhaps someone had dropped him a line, or perhaps one of his friends, his business friends that he'd been working with, has said, "Oh, you remember that nice guy that we met in Fairbanks? You never believe what happened."
Right.
But I did look in a couple of Disney autobiographies. I did contact the Disney Museum. There are several museums and a family museum as well, and they weren't able to help me. I mean, they just said, "Look, we don't quite have the resources and so forth to look for something like this." I can't imagine he even heard anything about it, because I'm sure he only met Cecil probably once or twice and spent a couple of days with him. And he might have heard about it and thought, "Oh, that's a shame, what a tragedy." But I doubt it was any more than that. But there is that picture of him and Cecil together. They did spend at least a day together. There was a group of them, and they were out feeding ground squirrels. And when they went up to, it looked like they had fun, and it was, it just showed that Cecil Wells was a player. He wouldn't have been picked to show these people around if he hadn't been important enough.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. So at the time of his visit to Alaska, Walt Disney was a household name. I mean, Disneyland hadn't been built yet, but he had already made some of his most famous movies at that point, like Snow White, Pinocchio, and Fantasia. So how come more Alaskans don't know about this fact that he came to Alaska back then?
I don't know, probably because it really was only reported like once or twice in the newspapers, and it wasn't reported in depth. I didn't find any articles with photographs or anything like that. I mean, I guess it was primarily sort of a business trip. I mean, everyone else was there for business, and it seems like they had a relatively tight schedule, because they went to Anchorage and to Fairbanks and to Candle as well, and they were also picking up a gold cleanup when they were in Candle, so they were actually doing some real business there. As to how much, research he was doing for his documentary, I don't know. But he was there with his daughter, and his daughter, she talked to a newspaper about it in 1956 when she was a sort of a grown up. And she remembered the trip very fondly. But she remembered, bumpy plane rides and the Northern Lights and things like that. She didn't remember too much else about what happened. But it did seem to be a trip that they enjoyed, and it certainly brought that documentary series together. I mean, the last time I went to the Disney studios here, the workplaces around here, because I live sort of near Burbank. The first thing I saw when I walked in the door was a poster for Seal Island, which I couldn't believe, because I was like, I've just been looking that up. And it's just sort of a strange story that's around it. But also, certainly, as you said, usually it's probably that Walt Disney didn't, or the Disney name, didn't want to get involved with anything that sounded unpleasant. And so a poor man being murdered in his bed in a sort of a racially divisive trial is probably not something where they would want to go. And he was a friend of Walt Disney, but because I he wasn't a friend. But like I say, they did meet. They were up in Alaska for a few days. It was a proper trip.
Well, James, what other times has Alaska been featured by Disney, to your knowledge, since that debut with Seal Island? I know of a few movies like Brother Bear and Togo, the Iditarod story. They both take place in Alaska. But are there any other movies, or are there even like hidden theme park gems for our Disneyland fans out there?
That's a good question. I don't know how many have there been. It's a subject that people, I think, even still today, Alaska is still something that fascinates people, and that they want to know more about it. There's often been an interest, but what I've always found is that I wish that they would actually film in Alaska when they did stories in Alaska, because often they don't do that, or they might just spend 1 or 2 days getting some exterior shots, say in Anchorage, and then film all the rest in, tax offering areas like Canada or somewhere down in California. Whereas I wish anything that they filmed, they really would film in Alaska.
Well, I want to thank my guest, journalist James Bartlett. He's based there in LA and is the author of the article When Walt Disney Came to Fairbanks. James, thanks for talking with me. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
After this short break, we'll be back with more Alaskan historical oddities with local author David Reamer. I'm Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and today we're uncovering some of Alaska's best historical gems. And I can't think of a better person to do that with than my next guest, friend of the show, David Reamer. He is a historian who writes for the Anchorage Daily News, and he also runs a really great Instagram account, by the way, that highlights some of our state's weirdest and most interesting history. He's here today with a short list of some of his favorite historical oddities, his top five, actually. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you. Before we get to your best of list, I have to ask, had you heard of this story that James Bartlett did about Walt Disney coming to Alaska originally for a business trip, where the supporting cast eventually turned into a true crime story?
I am familiar with the murder, Wells, the blonde, the love triangle, although I do not know enough about the Walt Disney and the Alaska connections. And that's something that I get to learn and listen about as well.
That's awesome. See, we had something new for you to learn historically. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's every day. You don't get into history without curiosity.
Oh, that's a good point. I just assume you know everything at this point, David. Well, let's get to your list. We're going to go number five to number one. We'll start with number five, the first weird piece of history you're bringing us today.
My list always evolves the things that I find the funniest, the most interesting. And number five, it's the relationship with Texas. The fact that the existence of Alaska as a state actually forced Texas to change part of their treasured lore, because Texans love their lore. The official state song of Texas is Texas, our Texas, because they love the sound of the word Texas. Originally written in 1929, includes these lines: Texas, our Texas, so wonderful, so great, largest and grandest, withstanding every test. The problem was, come 1959 in Alaska statehood, Texas was no longer largest, right, and debatably not grandest. And then that year, the song had been around for 30 years by that point. One of the authors was still alive, and he changed the line. He had to, and it now says boldest and grandest. They actually had to change their state song because of Alaska.
And that would explain some kind of hard feelings that Texans have toward Alaska. You were talking about this before we started recording, how Alaska kind of has a less braggadocious relationship with Texas. We do it a little bit, right? But they're apparently very sore about this subject.
There is Alaska pride in being Alaskan and in Alaska, but I've also spent several years in Texas, and it's an entire different mindset there. Texas pride is a much more outward state of mind there. It's part of the life and part of the culture and the way it isn't here. Like in Texas, you still go find Texas-sized portions. Here's a steak for a Texan. This is a Cadillac for a Texan because it's huge in a way you just don't see in Alaska, even though Alaska is much larger.
Right. Well, we actually have some audio of this song. So we're going to hear the original Texas song before they had to change their lyrics because of Alaska. No longer largest, and debatably, you say no longer grandest. I can see why you didn't want to sing that song, David. It's like, you know, it's got nothing. Now you're bringing out the competitive edge in me. Our state song is much better. I'm just going to say it. It's undebatable. Well, Ammon's in there nodding his head. He knows.
That's why Texans actually oft have several unofficial state songs. It's actually, there's another link to Alaska here. There is the Yellow Rose of Texas. There's Deep in the Heart of Texas, which if you sing the lines in a public place, you'll get Texans who'll respond. The biggest statehood party in Alaska wasn't in 1959, when Alaska officially became a state, but 1958, after Congress passed the Alaska Statehood Act. Eisenhower, president at the time, had already promised to sign the act, however reluctantly. So this was the moment, June 30th, 1958, when it became a certainty that Alaska was going to be a state. That was the big party. The streets of Anchorage were overflowing with cars back and forth. There was this giant flag hanging down from the old federal building downtown on 4th Avenue. They got out there in a ladder and they affixed another star to it in a big old ceremony. But there was a Texan in the crowd and he went into one of the bars. As everyone is cheering and celebrating Alaska statehood, he goes to the jukebox and he puts on the Yellow Rose of Texas. Again, one of those unofficial Texas state anthems. And it starts a fight and gets beat up. It was the wrong moment.
Not the right
Alaskans moment. Weren't and haven't been the most, devout in that belief that Alaska must be better than everything. But it was the exact wrong moment to push that button.
Agreed. Well, let's get to number four on your list there, David.
Bank robberies.
Oh, of course.
This was something I didn't know I would get into when I did history. There's a lot of topics like that I didn't think would interest me when I started doing history. But bank robberies, because they're usually awful. Smart criminals don't tend to rob banks because bank robberies through today have one of the highest clearance rates of any crimes. Like a third of all bank robbers are arrested that day, if not on the scene. It's just not a smart man's robbery.
Yeah, your odds are not good.
Yes, it's a movie. It's fantastic, like plot.
And but for top
real
five
life criminals don't do that. Do other crimes.
Right, right. You heard it from David Reamer. He's encouraging you to do better, smarter crimes. There's
an infamous one. It's not even a decade old in Anchorage. In 2018, there was a man, Michael Gale Nash, and he robbed a Midtown bank here in Anchorage. He handed a note to the teller saying, give me the money, put all the money in a bag. The note was a piece of his mail and had his name and address on the other side of it. And so, she did what tellers are supposed to do. She filled the bag, let him go. Nobody was hurt. The cops pull up. He's still right outside of the bank counting the money. That's bank robberies for you. But that's still not the worst bank robber in Alaska history.
Wow.
It gets much more deadly.
Okay.
1902, Skagway. Like, it's coming off of its gold rush peak when it was a gateway into the Klondike. The stranger walks into a bank there. It's just before closing time. It's quiet. It's just him, the stranger, the teller, and then a third man in the back who's sort of counting up receipts, closing business for the day. And the stranger reveals his hands to the teller. One, he has two sticks of dynamite, and in the other hand, he has a Colt revolver, an old one, and he demands $20,000 or else. Presumably, the teller was going to either get the Colt or the dynamite. Pretty clear. The teller, however, this is 1902. There was no little button underneath the desk. There right. was no, hardwired way to notify authorities. He's behind a little wooden wall. He just gets up and dashes for the back door. The bank robber is stunned into action. He didn't expect this, so he starts firing from the revolver. He fires once, he fires twice. They find these bullets in the wall. He fires a third time and hits the dynamite, which explodes. Explodes him, explodes much of the bank, blows out a hole in the wall. The rest of the walls sort of expand like it's a cartoon building breathing, stretching out as if the walls were made of elastic. That teller who's running for the back is blown out into the alley, but he's otherwise unharmed.
Oh, wow.
The third man, the other employee, he survives just fine as well. They don't mention concussions or hearing loss in these sort of coverage from 1902, but
sure.
There's no mention of it. They seem perfectly fine. The bank robber was somehow still lingering to life until he died about an hour later, missing, let's be honest, large pieces of himself.
Oh, wow.
From holding the dynamite that he shot. And that's not even the most gruesome aspect. They never figured out who he was. It's a small town. It's a place where they kept track of who was coming into town, who was leaving. This would be publicly printed in the newspaper, the list of passengers.
Yeah.
The people who would be staying in the hotels would also be recorded. But no one knew who he was. Never identified. He dies. His remains, what there was, were auctioned off.
Auctioned off?
His other remains. Not the body.
Oh, I thought you said his
what
remains.
Other possessions. However,
okay, got it.
His skull became a trophy and was actually displayed in a local shop for many, many years.
Like at the bank or somewhere else?
In a different shop.
Oh, a
just
trophy?
In the window. That was what you would see when you went to Skagway.
Wow. As a way to ward off robbers? Yeah. Or just a way like, this, welcome to Skagway, we've got a skull. And
like, there was no like shame in it. There was no guilt. This bank robber's fate was largely self-determined. They did it just as like, look at this interesting story that happened in our town. It was something right. The tour guides would show as they brought in the visitors. The tourists like, you know, here's where the gold came. Here's where Soapy Smith was. Here's where that bank robber blew up. And here's his skull in the window.
That was a great one. And I think that's the one thing the robber did right is never get identified, because I would not want to be identified after botching a robbery yeah. poorly.
See, we know the name of the Anchorage man who is still counting the money outside.
Okay,
when
yes.
the police arrived. This right. guy, we do not know.
We don't. All right, so moving on to number three. And just for those of you that are just joining us, I'm here with David Reamer. He's giving us his top five historical oddities of our state, and we're on number three now.
This one's a multi-layered story, but it has this one little detail that sort of not necessarily redeems it, but gives it an edge that it would otherwise not have, because everything else involved in this story is morbid and gruesome. In 1918, the Princess Sophia, this old steamship, the captain's running behind. He drives it straight ahead into a storm. He hits rocks, sits there for a while. Eventually, this horrible storm lifts it up, spins it around on the rocks. Huge hole ripped open in the ship. Everyone dies. The storm is so bad that there are ships in the vicinity who want to help but cannot approach, because they themselves would be washed onto the rocks and ripped open. Around 360 people died. Still the worst maritime disaster in Alaska history. And the horrible thing is, we do not know exactly how many people died. There was passenger list, there was crew list, but they both included people who were not on the boat, we can confirm. And they don't include people that we can confirm were on the boat. There are actually four bodies that were later recovered that were never identified. Horrible. Every single person died, except for a dog. And people love their dogs. So that I often, when I've talked about this in public, I can see the people light up like 360 people died, but the dog lived.
Yeah.
Tommy.
I mean, I won't lie. My heart got barely lighter when you told me.
About 2 days later, this scared-to-death dog drags itself out of the water at Auk Bay. This is all happening near Juneau. He's shaking. He's covered in oil. He's nearly exhausted to death. Oil had leaked out from the steamship as it was ripped open, and
oh, wow.
It was so thick in the water. And in the contemporary coverage, he's described as an English setter. His name was Tommy. The cannery people there briefly adopt him, although he had still a fear of water. They had a little bridge over a creek, and when they had to cross the bridge, he would kind of hunker down and stare straight ahead and scurry across as low as he could. Later evidence suggests that it might have actually been a Chesapeake Bay retriever, a Chessie, which would make a lot of sense because Chessies have webbed paws and waterproof fur. This would really make sense as to why Tommy was able to survive in the channel through a storm, through nasty conditions.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you know how far the dog had to swim?
Oh, a few miles.
Miles.
Okay. Yes, in a storm, in freezing water. This is late October.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. His family, yes, immediate family had died, but he was actually returned to the larger family and actually lived with them for the rest of his life. The one survivor of this great calamity.
Thank you, David. Well, moving on to the next item on your list, number two.
A happier dog story.
Oh, all right.
Patsy Ann. If you go down to Juneau, there is the cruise ship dock. And there is a statue of a little dog, a white bull terrier named Patsy Ann. The details of her life aren't the best known. She was sort of a, she was a legend in her own time, an oral legend. She kind of shows up in Juneau around 1930, apparently having freed herself, ran away from home. And she lived the rest of her life as that, as this free dog who went when and where she pleased, except for one detail. Any ship coming into Juneau, she had to be there to greet it. This became a known thing. There were postcards being sold, travel writers would say, to the point that other tourists, when they came to Juneau, they would look as they want, were walking off the boats, where's the dog? And there Patsy Ann would be, very eager for attention, for pets, for food. Patsy Ann ruled Juno in a certain way. She was eventually made, and there was a ceremony with the mayor down at the dock. You are the official greeter. And they knew Patsy Ann would be there because it fit her schedule, because a ship was arriving. Mm-hmm. There was no capture Patsy Ann and bring her to the ceremony. They timed it to Patsy Ann's schedule. And there was no capture her or take her somewhere after the ceremony because Patsy Ann was a free dog. During her life, there was a renewed interest in dog licenses and dog collars. The position of dog catcher was refilled and reemphasized in Juno. Loose dogs have always been a problem in Alaska. But this ran the dog catcher directly afoul of Patsy Ann, because the dog catcher said he was going to put a collar and capture Patsy Ann, and the public would not have this. People poured into his office. We will buy the collar for Patsy Ann. You just leave that poor, loyal, official greeter dog alone. He finally had to surrender. Patsy Ann was officially granted unique status because she was, of course, the official greeter. And she just did what she wanted to when the ships were coming in. If there was a baseball game, she would go and steal the baseball. If there was a play once, and during the play, Patsy Ann walked in, walked up and down the aisles, made sure that she was a part of the ceremony, and then left. She was a proud union dog, as best as we can tell. Her favorite place was with the longshoremen. Down at their union hall, that was her favorite place to sleep. Although not her only one, because she was a free dog. Mm. There would be Labor Day parades, and she would ride with the longshoremen, which you could not force Patsy Ann to do anything. So we know by her presence that she was pro-union. And she slowed down. She was maybe pampered a little too much, got a little too heavy. She finally passed away in 1942 in the longshoremen's union hall. And 50 years later, there was that statue that if you go there to Juno, you have to go and pet and rub its good little head. Installed 50 years after Patsy Ann passed away.
Well, speaking of Disney and dog movies, I feel like we have a few more Alaska dog movies that have some real potential there other than just Balto. So, but I'll leave that up to people that make a lot more money than I do.
There's Togo, there's Baldy, yes.
Yeah, totally. All right, well, David, it's time. Time for your number one item on your list. And I do know about this one just very vaguely, but looking forward to everyone else hearing it.
One of the absolutely silliest things about Alaska, this beautiful slice of history, it's nothing but joy and fun and nobody gets hurt.
Okay.
The fact that there has been not one but two volcano hoaxes in Alaska, and that you can have a favorite volcano hoax here. There's the one that's much more famous and gets brought up every April Fool's Day. April 1st, 1974, Porky Picard in Sitka. Him and a team of pranksters had planted all these tires up on top of Mount Edgecombe, waited for the day, lit it on fire, made it seem as if this dormant volcano had come to life, scaring every single person in town. He had even warned all the authorities so he would not get in trouble. He had forgotten the Coast Guard, who sent a helicopter out to the scene to investigate. And as he flies over the edge, he looks down and is expecting to see lava. Instead, he sees an April Fool's message carved out, laid out with tires. It's a famous incident. He had a jacket made to celebrate it, would wear it around town. It said, "Porky's Rising." Great moment. But there was another earlier volcano hoax. In 1957, UAF, what's now the University of Alaska Fairbanks, then was just the University of Alaska, there was a geology professor named Harry Groom and a couple of students who were a bit silly. He's cross-eyed in his yearbook photo that year, the professor. That day in question, Groom and his students were upset because the Army had reneged on a promise to take them out to a volcano site far, far away in the Aleutians. He was disappointed. He was a little upset. He definitely had more free time on his hands than he had expected. So this professor and his students start a rumor that a peak in the Brooks Range was exploding. Not just erupting, but being absolutely blown apart in a very end-of-day situation. That the seams of a massive mountain were coming apart. The lava was flowing as if a mighty river. This was in times. And the rumor starts passing around town. It passes through the school. Soon the radio station is covering, "Have you heard?" Again, with absolutely no verification, no basis in fact. There's no authority that they could say or bring up or talk to or hold up as a proof that this was actually happening, but they freaked out. Grocery stores started getting calls like, "Do you have enough food if the lines of supply are shut down? Do you have enough in case there's this grand emergency?" The students go to bed that night. This is still when the dorms were where most of the students lived and when they had very separated girls and boys dorm with strict lockdown times. You couldn't enter the girls' dorm after a certain time for some reason. And a couple of guys up to no good had some dynamite. This was a school surrounded by mining with an emphasis on mining. In a looser day in Alaska. So dynamite wasn't impossible to get a hold of.
Seems so like it's not hard to get a hold of at all. It's based on your other story.
And so just right outside of campus on Loop Road, they blow up the dynamite. And apparently you could hear the screams from the girls' dorm. You could hear the women yelling out, "But I have so much I have yet to do. Oh, no. There's so many things I haven't done yet." You could see boyfriends and girlfriends making tearful promises. "We will be together no matter what." The professor and his gleeful little students sent out the word that they were going to need to mount an expedition to this site, actually investigate what was happening, because this sounds really, really bad. Knowing inside this whole time that it was a silly rumor that they themselves had started.
Right.
They were like, "We're going to pay $50 a head. You come, you sign up. We're going to pay more if you are willing to parachute down to the site, which will be deadly. We need people with wilderness experience, people with their own weaponry, because who knows what wildlife we run into that will be frenzied by the rivers of lava and the mountain being torn asunder underneath your feet. So you need to be prepared." So the next morning, there are pictures of this. They are glorious. A bunch of these students appear. They're carrying their gear, rifles on their shoulders on campus, waiting for their ride to the site. The professor and the other students just giggle, and they never show up. These students that showed up expecting to get paid for this life-threatening journey to investigate the scene of this cataclysm eventually have to slowly figure it out themselves that it was all a hoax. And they had to sit there, half hour, nobody's left, hour, couple of people have, like, "I'm curious, I haven't heard anything else about this, I'm gonna go." Rest of them, it takes forever for all of them to finally leave. All embarrassed, they've all been had. But they loved it. It became this beloved story on campus immediately. The only person that was upset was an army commander who was mad that he had been falsely claimed as supporting the idea that he was behind the expedition to the volcano.
Wonderful story and great list. Thank you, David. 1 through 5 there. Loved them all. You had a perfect sprinkling of Alaskana in there. Some dogs, some cruise ships, dynamite, and of course, the size of our state versus Texas. Very good. I want to thank my guest, David Reamer. He's a historian that writes for the Anchorage Daily News. Also runs that fantastic Instagram account under the name ANC_historian. Thanks again, David. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for our show. Thanks to our guests, James Bartlett and David Reamer. Ammon Swenson produces this show. You can find us at the Hometown Alaska page on alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Dave Waldron, and thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.